if there's the sense that I'm dirty, there's sticky on the skin, the sense of seeking cleansing, then one wants to shower. If there's a sense of I don't need cleansing, I want continuity. I want continuation of what I'm of my current state. Then there might be the desire not to take a shower. Likewise, if one feels bored, the people who are saying how do you keep it fresh want to be not bored. And actually, I think it's very not helpful to seek meditation to be fresh every time, because it won't be, because it isn't, because that's just not the mind. The mind is not. It's like a person who, eats ice cream every day because they want the same happy feeling, but sometimes they actually don't feel happy, but they do it anyway. I want the same state of mind again and again. That's not meditation. Meditation is not for the purpose of achieving a state of mind and keeping it every time. That's what jhana. Jhana can be like that. If you can get into jhana, the trances, and some meditators have that skill, every single time they meditate, they get into the higher jhanas. Period. Absolutely, that's possible. But it's not possible for a person who still has aversion to boredom. Getting the freedom of mind or the development of concentration that gets one to the jhana, invariably, in my understanding experience, goes through boredom or involves freedom from aversion to boredom. One feels bored and one continues meditating, similar to that teacher saying, because he knows it's a good thing to do. And it's inevitable that we feel boredom and no fresh in meditation, and that's considered fine. And if you seek to be away from that, or you get rid of your boredom every time, that's just meditation. That's spiritual materialism. That's spiritual bypass. I don't want to feel boredom. I want to get high every time. That's why some people do certain types of meditation, like more Hindu type, like chanting, where they can get into some kind of state of mind every time. And there's nothing wrong with that. And again, skilled meditators can go into the higher jhanas every single time they sit down. But that's only because they're free of aversion and grasping at such deep levels of mind that they can go through the boredom, and then openings occur, and joy, and then jhanas, develop. So I think using meditation to be free of boredom or not wanting boredom is just another hindrance. And one, I mean, I've sat through lots and lots and lots and lots of meditation of boredom. And every single time, if I sit long enough, the boredom goes away and there's a greater clarity that comes on the other side of allowing and sitting through boredom. First of all, there are eight jhanas. There's a big difference between the first four and the second four jhanas. The first four are not formless. The first four are associated with the capacity for directed thought, meaning the person can still think. In the other four jhanas, formless jhanas, a person actually is not thinking, and therefore cannot develop certain kind of insight, the insight as to the three marks, anicca, anatta, dukkha, or seeing into the nature of phenomena, that kind of investigation in meditation cannot be done in the higher four jhanas. So now to get to sotapanna, absolutely the person has to be in a concentrated state of mind, quiet mind, where one, Ra talked about this as silence of mind at a steady state. In the Bali material, it's called holding the mind steady in the light. It's not different than samadhi. But that samadhi, again, can go into the first four jhanas, and one can still think, and or the person can go further in concentration, and there is no thinking, and one falls into a jhana, which is not a problem, but it doesn't lead to insight or awakening. The four higher jhanas, which are basically infinity of space, infinity of consciousness, perception of nothingness, and then neither perception nor non-perception. And so these are very abstracted states of being or mind. where insight doesn't come. It seems to me it's absolutely necessary to get the mind into samadhi, which is associated with any of the first four states of jhana. It's associated with all of the jhanas, but the first four states of jhana, which ultimately it's the fourth jhana that I think is critical. And there is a phrase in Buddhism called access concentration, a very technical term. And I believe it's associated with the level of samadhi. I believe it's third and fourth jhana, where one can still think, where one has access to insight or seeing the nature of phenomena and mind as is. So I think it's absolutely necessary to have to be able to move into samadhi, the higher, the third or the fourth jhana, to be able to move to insight and sotapanna, yes, but not the latter four jhanas. And other teachers will say, because concentration is the key to the whole thing, whether it's the first four or the second four jhanas, concentration leads the way. Some will say that that it's extremely helpful to be able to go into the higher four jhanas too, and I think that's true. It's considered very helpful, but it may not be necessary. But certainly what is necessary is a deep enough concentration, equanimity, right? That's really, we're talking about equanimity, and a quiet mind or silence of mind at a steady state, where directed thought is still possible, fourth jhana, where insight can arise naturally. Yes, I think that's important. But that's not formless. That's the lower four jhanas, not the higher four. You know, the guys who get complete and perfect enlightenment, they really want it. And they really want it so sincerely and truly that they have no friction in mind about doing or not doing practice. There's nothing else they want. And at that point, the path is super straight and clear, and it doesn't take that much time, actually. But much of the path is getting to the point where we are naturally free of resistance to practice. And one way that it ends up inevitably leading to a freedom from resistance to practice is not practicing. Giving oneself the freedom to not practice. And if you want to feel guilty, you feel guilty. And if you want to practice, practice. And if you don't, you don't. And if you feel guilty, okay, I feel guilty. But that doesn't mean I'm a shithead. It just means I know it's good, but I still don't want to do it. Okay, then don't do it. Fine. No, I feel bad. Okay, then feel bad you don't do it. Who cares? You don't want to do it? Don't do it. You feel bad? Feel bad. When you're finished with that whole cycle, you'll want to do it, and there won't be resistance. And so, I'm not encouraging not practice, and I'm not encouraging feeling shitty and guilty. But it inevitably happens that we don't do what we know is good all the time or regularly. There are lots of things we think, you know, do the right thing. We know what the right thing is. The more practice, the better. And we still have resistance, which means ambivalence, which means we don't, which means we often feel guilty and shame and self-blame. That whole cycle has to be finished before the person has a unified motivation. Has single-minded intention. Single-minded, unified intention. I only want attainment. Nothing else. And I really will go through whatever, like Gautama sitting under the tree, that the final night of awakening. I'm going to sit here until I either die or achieve awakening. Because there's no other desire in the mind. And at that point, one goes straight and very quickly, fetters are broken. But to get to that point is the great work. And that's what the, you know, you can say that the purpose of reincarnation is to solidify aversion to grasping aversion and ignorance, to solidify disinterest, detachment, dispassion from all forms of grasping or all forms of, you know, controlling phenomena or life or seeking other than attainment, other than seeking the goal. And so likewise, by multiple reincarnations in multiple dimensions, beings experience countless phenomena of mind or mind-matter or, you know, fashioning of experience. And at the end of that, there is a great awareness and a real naturally formed disinterest, dispassion from any kind of clinging and craving and, you know, hunger for states of mind. And when the thirst for states of mind goes away, then there's no more resistance and no more avoidance of doing the right thing or doing a good thing, because that's the only thing we want. But that takes many lifetimes, actually. I mean, I think people should do what they want to do. Yeah, well, I think that there's a great value to going as deep as possible with any teaching before jumping to other teachings, and jumping from teaching to teaching is not a great idea either. And so I agree with that. You can say it's all the mind. That's a sort of a cheap shot and easy to say, but there is, you know, each person ought to be picking and choosing as they see fit, as they see best, and he does that, and other people who jump around are also following their natural inclination. His inclination is that it's enough jumping around, I got what I want, I just want to go deeper with what I have. And other people may not have that same commitment or depth of appreciation for whatever they're doing, so they keep jumping to other things. But it's certainly not necessary to go jumping and jumping and understand everybody's point about everything to achieve, you know, to continue achieving and growing and transforming. So, because, I mean, you know, you began with the whole question of making peace with non-practice or freshness versus keeping meditation practice fresh versus boredom. You're welcome. I don't think it's possible to keep practice fresh. And also, this whole approach of curiosity, I'm not that kind of person. And my approach for myself has been very very one-dimensional in terms of motivation for practice. I know the more practice, the better. Maybe 12 hours a day is not so great, but I don't think that 8 hours a day is a problem. Not that I'm doing it. I did before. But in general, until one gets to a very heavy level of practice, the more the better. And whether practice is painful or joyous, it's always good. It's always helpful. I know it's the right thing, always. And therefore, I know that if we talk about should, I should be practicing hour after hour, or it's more important, ultimately, actually, than reading, you know? And in the end, I think it's okay to follow the line of least resistance, and if that means not practicing and feeling guilty, okay, then don't practice and feel guilty. But hardening the guilt into self-punishment, self-blame, I hate myself, I'm such a loser, is making trouble. It's unnecessary. It's not deserved. We don't deserve that. We do many things that are good for ourselves and many things that are good for others. We're not perfect, but we're not losers and we're not terrible people. And if we don't want to do something that's very difficult, that's okay, you know? And if we do some but not all of something that's very difficult, meditation is very difficult. Gautama said it's like swimming upstream. Anybody who says they enjoy all the time in meditation is either going into jhana or they're fooling themselves, or they're listening to, you know, music and doing a kind of a happy mind type practice technique. To try to get back again into some high state. But the high state is just a formless jhana, and it doesn't lead to necessarily transformation, and it can definitely allow lower chakra blockages to remain. It's very common. People get high in practice and then come off, and they still have the same petty mind or grasping and aversion or jealousies and insecurities or aggression of some type. It's very common. Even though they've done years of practice in jhanas and feel so happy in it. And maybe they have no guilt because they practice all the time because they want to get high and they can. But they still may have blockages that they haven't worked through. So real meditation, to me, vipassana, mindfulness, non-grasping, formless meditation, is difficult. And therefore, it's okay if one doesn't do it, because one doesn't always want to do something difficult, even if it's the right thing and always helpful. Okay. And but the whole notion of curiosity, I never had curiosity, never, in meditation. I had pain, and I had clarity. What I know in meditation is pain and clarity. If I'm in some pain, or if I simply long for samadhi, which is not moving out of pain or a deep pain, but a very maybe minor disturbance in mind, but the longing for samadhi is a great motivation, or the longing for transformation. And so one can meditate coming off of with the motivation to get out of the pain, for the longing for samadhi, or for the desire for a jhana. I want to get high, I want to get into that trance. Or, I know this is the way of transformation, it's done so much for me so long, and I want more. You see, vichara, inquiry, yes, like Ramana Maharshi taught aham vichara. I'm not interested in the mind. I'm interested in freedom. Yeah, what I'm saying is, it's very similar to the teachings of Weibu Sayadaw from Burma, who basically had the view, I think, that sustained fourth jhana samadhi naturally goes to vipassana and insight. That shamatha vipassana are not separate. And so fourth jhana samadhi means that you're sitting in meditation in equanimity. And you can still think. But the thinking is very limited, or there's not, the mind is not autonomously producing thought, but the mind is quiet. And in that equanimity, one sees. However, one is not going into a formless trance, one can still think. But one is staying with the body-mind process in real time, mindfulness of basically body-mind. At that point, there's very little breathing, and so most of the time is basically watching very subtle release, a very subtle, complex release process of body-mind. The breathing is really slow, and there's not much thinking at all, but directed thought is totally possible. And one stays with that. As one stays with that, that's the vichara. It's not a thought-based vichara. It's a mindfulness-based vichara. Meaning the inquiry, vichara, aham vichara, self-inquiry, Ramana Maharshi's teaching. My understanding of the vichara in fourth-level samadhi, or fourth, you know, jhana samadhi, is that keeping simply with the mindfulness of the body-mind process, which is mainly very, very subtle at that point because there's very little breathing and there's very little thinking. The vichara is sustained mindfulness in that state. And the result of that is that openings naturally happen, or insight comes, all sorts of things come naturally, including a deeper understanding of anicca anatta dukkha. Particularly, anatta and anicca, because there's very little dukkha there, or the dukkha is extremely subtle. The dukkha comes when I'm trying to do something other than that. to then bring some curiosity is very crude. To bring some curiosity, okay, now I'm going to be curious about my mind process. There is no mind process. There's nearly no mind process. You know, I have to confess that basically I learned from a number of teachers in the early 80s And since that time, I've gone off and done it my own way. My own way is not much different than some of what I've read in Weibu Sayada, where the higher, the further reaches of samadhi become vipassana. And that there really is no hard and fast line between calm abiding samadhi or fourth jhana. Fourth jhana meaning equanimity. I mean, if we want to look at the jhanas, let me just see if I can find a page that shows something cleanly. Try this Wikipedia page. Fourth jhana, akusala dhamma, right? We talk about akusala, michaditi, wrong view, but akusala, fetter, basically taints or asravas, unhelpful tendencies. So sensuality, unskillful qualities don't arise. Applied thought, sustained thought doesn't arise. rapture arises. Pleasure is abandoned. There's mindful, no pleasure or pain. Okay, that's pure equanimity in that fourth jhana. So actually, I'm wrong that applied thought, there's actually sustained thought only in the first jhana. What I found, frankly, is that no questions arise. No questions arise. So I'm not curious about anything. But that doesn't mean I'm sleepy. Or I might be sleepy, but it doesn't have to be sleepy. basically, my goal is to stay mindful moment by moment to the continuing body-mind process. Now, you know, there's body-mind-spirit, but spirit is, you know, spirit sort of breaks through into body-mind with insight. So it's not that I'm tracking a spirit process, but I'm clearly tracking mindful moment-to-moment of a body-mind process, like the breathing and what's happening in the mind. Okay. What happens then, there's no curiosity, oh, let me discover anicca anatta dukkha, because what I found is that insights, particularly about anatta, come naturally. Meaning, there is a recognition that what I used to have, I don't have. That I used to have something that I know I don't have. What I used to have, what I realize I don't have, is substantive selfhood. The ahamkara, this sense of identity, of thought-based identity, is gone. And there's the recognition that I used to have it, but I don't have it now. Or thought-based identity doesn't arise in that state. And many, many things become clear along with that. But I've never meditated because I was curious. I meditated because I want the freedom, the goal, what comes. And when there's no thought arising, it seems silly for me to make thought, to make a distortion, make a thought obscuration in mind where the mind was clear without thought. The idea of I'm going to be curious about my mind when I know that this mind is an illusion or that thoughts are empty seems silly to me. I'm not curious about the illusory. I know it's illusory. I know that it's impermanent and insubstantial. I'm not curious about the illusory. I'm actually longing for, you know, freedom. But that freedom comes from non-action, non-grasping, and not a freedom that can be obtained by a doing other than the doing of non-doing. The doing of non-doing is mindfulness. Mindfulness is watching without grasping an aversion, or watching all that arises and meeting it, seeking to be free of grasping. and recognizing when there's grasping, and when there's aversion, and when there's thought, and then moving back to the objects of concentration, which at that point are very subtle. For me, the practice has always been my primary teacher, not a human. And of course I get insight, and of course, or I get guidance and inspiration from higher beings comes in meditation, of course. But I'm not seeking a Dhamma. I'm not seeking any Dhamma. I'm not seeking samskara. I'm seeking what's on the other side of seeking. I know that on the other side of seeking is total emancipation. And so I'm seeking, by mindfulness, watching, non-grasping, to allow the natural process of mind self-liberation, which is basically prana. You know, you see, when the mind is held steady and quiet in whether first or fourth jhana, circulation of prana from root to crown continually improves. On each round, one is deepening samadhi. Each round of respiration, and actually each round of root to crown kundalini circulation, up the spine, down the front, up the spine, down the front. Each round, that's the law of squares as applied to mindfulness and samadhi. Steady mindfulness by the law of squares deepens samadhi, which is done by the pranic flow from root to crown that naturally happens, going through chakras that are increasingly unblocked by the desire to be free of grasping and aversion, or the mindfulness practice, which demonstrates freedom from grasping and aversion, because you're just watching. Whatever it is, it's okay, and when there's grasping and aversion, I recognize it and go back to the, you know, very subtle mind-body object of concentration. And the result of that is that all sorts of clarity comes naturally, and reality teaches, and not a mind-based, not a thought-based seeking. It's a whole being offering to offering self to mindfulness-based revelation. Right, right, right. There are different approaches, but I have found that when I went to teachers, even in my 20s at the earliest times, I almost never had questions. I almost never knew what to ask them, because I had that very clear, maybe it was mistaken view, but my view was very clear at that point, which has not changed too much till today, which is that all I need is more practice. And the practice is my primary teacher. The practice being the revelation by sustained mindfulness. Sustained mindfulness, which goes to, you know, any of the jhanas, by sustained mindfulness and a commitment to non-grasping at mind-body process, whatever it may be, even if one gets caught, one returns back to non-grasping by simply returning to mindfulness. Meaning, whatever I'm feeling, whatever I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to turn my attention back to the breath. And then if you go to very, you know, deep, slow respiration phases in meditation or practice, experience meditation, there's not much mind-body experience to be mindful of. It's very, very subtle. The final point is, the teacher is the ultimate the practice is the ultimate teacher. Mindfulness, commitment to mindfulness, I have found for myself, is the ultimate teacher. And it's the technique that, it's as much as a blessing as the teachings of the Buddha Dhamma. I found that the technique of mindfulness, a primary blessing, a jewel or gift from Gautama to the world. Because that practice, which is quite distinct from all other meditations that are object goal based, you know, getting into a certain state or moving energy and manipulating by mind, this is a practice of surrendering all functions other than attentiveness. But attentiveness, you can say, is curiosity. Okay, that's fine. But I prefer to call it attentiveness, or simply staying with the objects of concentration. So it's not an intellect. You know, for me, it was always silly to bring thoughts to mind when I didn't have thoughts in mind. I could bring thoughts to the mind, but I wasn't in the circulation of thoughts in mind. And so it seemed, it's like, you know, in Buddhism it's called putting a head on your head, putting a head on top of your head. For me, to fashion thoughts when there were no thoughts, but rather stay with the mindfulness, and all sorts of things keep changing and developing. All sorts of things happen. And very much in line with traditional Buddhist insight, vipassana, regarding the three marks. Particularly anatta. Anicca, impermanence, is no big deal, right? We can be aware of that. But anatta, most people don't know. And anatta is simply known with the deepening of form-based jhanas, samadhi. It comes naturally. My experience of it, whether it's a sotapanna or not, I don't know, somebody can tell me, is akin to realizing what I used to have that I see I don't have. Not realizing that something isn't there exactly. It's realizing that, I guess you could say, it's realizing that what used to be here is not here, which was that the samskara of ahamkara, or self-identity, selfhood, anatta, you know, a sense of separative identity, is seen to have existed before, but now not. And that doesn't come by asking a mental, by fashioning thought. It comes by sustained freedom from thought and attentiveness, which you can call curiosity, but curiosity gives a lot of thinking Westerners the wrong idea, because they really have a hard time moving into thoughtlessness or non-production of thought. So I never had any curiosity. I had pain and the desire to be free of pain, and joy and the desire for more joy that comes with insight. It's not the joy of formless jhanas joy for me. It was the joy of seeing falsehood fall away, seeing mind-based illusory veils fall away, in a way that's actually non-conceptual. It's not even, you know, I'm not talking about freedom from patterns of thought, because there are no patterns of thought in those jhanas. There are thoughts that come and go, but the psychological processes are somewhat dismantled. That doesn't mean the blockages are all gone. It just means that they're not arising in those states. But sustained beingness, attentively, mindfully, at that level, for me, has led to natural seeing and deep level, and a sense of deep level, deep mind freeing. That's really non-conceptual, meaning. I've had this process many times in meditation where there's I perceive a kind of gestalt of thought arising and being released, but I couldn't identify it conceptually. Meaning there's some kind of thing that just a bundled complex simply arose and just passed away, but I can't say what it was. And to me, that's akin to pre-conscious deep mind distortions or blockages being released. And it's associated with all sorts of other physiological changes, with digestion and elimination and the whole pranic flow from root to crown, actually, as well as energy changes and tinglings and energy manifestations. And that's one way to know that things are working. So meditation is the way home, if you want it. But you have to be willing to surrender the intellect. You have to be willing to just keep watching and go through any emotional fear of I'm losing myself and I'll be destroyed or I'll go to a void and never come back, and just trust the practice and trust your beingness that does the practice. Trust true nature. And it's not your true nature or our true nature, it's true nature. And true nature does the practice, and true nature is revealed when sufficient attachments, particularly very deep mind and preconscious, non-conceptual, they don't even arise conceptually when they're released. And it's all associated with the pranic flow. And it's very much associated, I found, with how much time one devotes to doing that. The more the better. If you meditate for 6 hours a day, yeah, it really is better than 1 hour a day, no matter what anybody says, in my opinion. In line with actually a Tibetan mystic, a guy who sat most of his life in caves in Tibet, he said something like, practice is everything. And I completely agree with that. You can see video of this guy. He looks like a dreadlock type. He died a few years ago. He was somebody the Dalai Lama looked up to. And I really think that that's true. Practice is everything. There are all sorts of other good things. Yes, true. Okay, fine. But if you want rapid transformation in ways that are not going to be determined by intellect, not led by intellect, practice is the way. Yeah, I mean, it's the path of seven chakra transformation, the path of total mind, body, spirit, you know, transformation, liberation, development, perfection, whatever. And it's a question of to what extent people get stuck along the way. we are where we're stuck. We're stuck where we are. We are where we are because we're attached where we are. And all of our attachments are the result of persistent deep mind attachment. All of our blockages and distortions and chakra issues and all that are the result of persistent deep mind attachment or clinging to those bases of distortion that come out as thoughts and feelings. And meditation cuts it all away, actually. I mean, mindfulness, the mindfulness practice I'm not saying I'm finished at all, of course, obviously, but I have the utmost faith in a very, very simple form of Anapanasati, just as Weibu Sayadaw was followed the way of Anapanasati. That was the original practice, I believe, and it takes us, I have no doubt that it can take us all the way. I haven't gone all the way, but I'm sure that it can take one all the way to, you know, complete and perfect awakening. And, practice is everything, actually, if you want rapid transformation. I mean, there are two bases, right? Either I'm in pain, I want to get out of pain, or I've felt joy and freedom and clarity and I want more of it. And one's desires, or one's pain keeps decreasing, unless, you know, there are periodic times of great chakra blockage and mini crisis and things. Aside from that, one's basic mind-body-spirit complex levels of dukkha decrease over time. Likewise, one's familiarity with freedom or ease, equanimity in daily life, increase. And therefore, the motivational set for meditation keeps changing. So, depends on all sorts of things. But finding it's absolutely true that going from teaching to teaching or practice to practice is not great. Is not a good way to go. It happened very early for me. that I settled on a couple of practices, and I've been basically with that for 30 years. So it's important to, I mean, some people have been monks in past lives, and some people have done the same practices in past lives they may be doing today. That helps a lot, of course. So if there's no sense of that for somebody, then it's a little bit harder, and you got to find what works. But I don't think there's any way to keep meditation fresh. I never thought about keeping meditation fresh. When I don't want to do it, I don't. When I do, I do. And you're going to have to go through what you got to go through, right? All the lower realms of mind, right? Hungry ghost, longing desire mind, and the sorrow that comes from not having what we want, and the sorrow that comes from, you know, not having what we like and not being able to get rid of it, and the anger of this, that, and the other thing, anger, aversion toward this, that, and the other thing, and deep levels of fear and bafflement and confusion and disorientation and, you know, disturbance. One has to go through all that. How else? How else? You can't keep a happy time. Right. Well, I think the key is to get beyond self-conflict. And it means accepting that sometimes I don't want to do what I know is good for me. And I want to do it my way, and I want to take it slow, and I don't want the stress of doing a good thing or a right thing sometimes. I want the easy and comfortable and without challenge, or I want a different challenge, or I want to just... I don't want to do that sometimes. And even though it's good for me, and I know it would help me, and maybe even I'm in pain, but I just want to... I don't want to do it now. Maybe I will later. I want to fully want it. And I don't fully want it. And I want to wait till I fully want it before I do it. Okay. Then wait till you fully want it before you do it, and accept that I want it, but I don't fully want it, and that's okay. And I'm not trying to hurt myself, but I don't fully want it. And so I'm going to do it only when I fully or more strongly want it. Okay. I think that's fine. I think that's how I would work with that. I mean, the point is not to be at war with oneself. That is not helpful. So if the choice is between practicing at war with oneself and not practicing more peaceful with oneself, then I think the latter is better. All right, well, thank you for being here. And I appreciate it. Very interesting talk about practice and transformation. See you next time. Take good care of yourselves, and good night.